This is Inside Open Wheel with your host, Jeremy Scott.
From the Dracow Multimedia Studios just outside of Chicago, this is Inside Open Wheel. Hello, everybody. Jeremy Scott here with you. We've got a packed show for all our listeners. And by the way, we're now on YouTube. So if you're watching this on YouTube, probably just listening to it, by the way, welcome. We thank you for joining us. You can find us all past episodes on any podcast service available. So today we talk with Ryan Sheehan. He is going to run Formula 4 as a rookie of the year with Crosslink, and he's coming up through karting. So this will be his first full season of quote-unquote big cars. We'll talk about him with that. The Inside Open Wheel 225 happened last Sunday, and it was my first foray in actually watching a full sim race. Yes, I know it's a little surprising, even though I did watch bits and pieces of the IndyCar Challenge, and we'll discuss that. Also, it's our Legends of Open Wheel series kicking off once again with the one, the only, Paul Page. It's a fantastic conversation I had with Paul earlier in the week, and I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. So, as always, at Facebook and Twitter, at Inside Open Wheel, our Google Voice voicemail is 815-714-9260. As always, our driver analyst, Charlie Ante, joins us. And I've got to say this, Charlie, we've seen these schedules, you know, get mixed around. We saw Formula One change where their opening race is going to be. It looks like it's going to be in Bahrain. But we haven't really been short on driver announcements in these past couple of weeks. They've been really popping left and right. And I don't know about you, but I'm really excited about these.
Yeah, and I think they've been happening a lot sooner than usual. I mean, if my memory serves me right, they sort of start happening like end of February, sort of early March.
Yeah.
And there's kind of a mad dash like the few weeks before the season starts. So I think that bodes very well. You know, the earlier that you can sign someone, the more stability you have, and the earlier you can start to prepare. So it's a good thing to see.
And it helps that they're testing earlier, and kudos to the Academy. I think that has a big part to play in it. We'll talk more about that in a couple of weeks because the Winter Series is going to be kicking off with the Academy. But, you know, it's great to see, you know, and we're seeing these junior formula teams expand as well. And I'll explain more on that as well, because we do have a driver coming in next week who is part of a team that is expanding in the junior formulas. But one thing I do want to get to real quick, FR America's Winter Cup just announced yesterday that they've got a venue change. Now, they were supposed to be at Homestead Miami Speedway, but with NASCAR's schedule, with them staying in Florida a week or two longer, they're actually going to move up, I'm going to say up the road, even though I know how big Florida is. It's, you know, a heck of a haul. They're going to go from Homestead Miami Speedway up to Sebring International Raceway February 19th to the 21st, and that's about the time when SVRA has rented the track for their facility. And of course, now we know Pirelli Motorsports Holdings promotes both the F4 FRA championships, and they also promote SVRA. So it makes sense, you know. So we'll see both of those series running there at the backbreaking off-road, should be labeled as an off-road facility, you know, the Sebring International Raceway. I'm kidding in case anybody thinks I'm serious, even though I'm still upset over the new pair of shoes that I got trashed because I was walking on that tarmac.
How did you trash a pair of shoes at Sebring?
Have you never been on Sebring's paddock space at all?
It's been a while, I guess.
Yeah, I had a good pair of shoes, and this is when I was with, you know, that semi-pro Porsche series. And with all the walking I did, the tarmac just ate up my shoes.
You know, it's kind of funny because my mind went in a completely different direction because we're talking about rough surface. So I thought, well, Sebring obviously has a famously rough racing surface. Yeah. And so that's where the track that my mind was going down. So I was like, how did you wear down your shoes on the racetrack? That doesn't make any sense. So I pictured you like, sort of like
Fred Flintstone.
I don't even know
it.
How to describe it, like sliding along the track at racing speeds on your feet.
I was going to say Fred Flintstoning it around the course. Oh, that's possible too.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. So yeah, that was an interesting few seconds.
So we'll see what the schedule holds for F4 and the FR America's Winter Cup. We'll keep tabs on that as well. staying in the junior formula realm, and that's basically what most of the show is going to be about today, is junior formula and sim racing, albeit safer, Paul Page. TireRack.com iRacing E-Series has released their schedule. It's basically 6 straight weeks of racing. So you got February 3rd, the Road to Indy competitors at Road America, then the Raceway at Belle Isle Park, Iowa Speedway, WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca, Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course, and the Worldwide Technology Raceway, the All-Star Invitational event. We're going to find out more from Rob Howden next week. He's going to be on the show. We're going to talk about his new position, and we're going to talk more about this because I'm interested to see, you know, who the entries are, because I know he's been teasing me like, hey, I'm going to have him. Gonna have him, so we're gonna do the good journalistic duty and press him on that one.
And I think you should mention, if you have the information available, what time those races are and where folks can watch them.
I remember last year it was on apexracing.com, so I would imagine that they are going. It's going to be there, so I'm sure that these kinks are getting worked out. They do have cash prizes announced for that. Competitors in the TireRack.com Road to Indy iRacing E-Series presented by Cooper Tires will vie for cash prizes of over $3,500, including a champion's prize of $2,000 and a one-hour sim time at every race on the 2021 schedule provided by Symmetric Driver Performance Labs, the official sim partner of the Road to Indy, as well as special awards in each round, such as the Saba at Sabal, correct?
What is this?
The safety company, Saybelt.
Oh, I in my mind, I read it as Saybelt.
Okay, so we'll call it Saybelt. If I'm wrong, please tell me. Saybelt Hard Charger Awards provides a pair of Saybelt Hero Racing Gloves to the driver who gains the most positions. They will be using, I thought I saw the new Tatus PM18. Let me see if I can find it. I did see it somewhere, but in the press release, Rob did say that this is to open the door for some junior formula drivers with an eye on the Road to Indy that had season schedule conflicts. So we'll talk more about this with Rob Howden next week, but it's great to see that these series are starting to embrace e-racing as something as a warm-up to the series, you know, not necessarily a replacement, because, you know, it's there to, as a placeholder, I should say.
Yeah. I think I said it last weekend that you could see some rivalries start to develop in this. And it will also sort of might be interesting to see how, because it is a different skill set. So people that might excel in the sim racing world might struggle to certain degrees, more or less, in the real world. So it will be interesting to see how things compare.
Well, we do have more driver and team announcements as we take a look at what has been announced since we were last on the air. And we do have, let's see, don't have anything in Formula 4 FRA. We were supposed to have some FRA announcements, but there's some of these announcements have been held back because Honda was supposed to announce a day or two ago what was going to happen with their scholarship. As you remember, last year Honda fronted a scholarship for the championship driver to go to Indy Lights. We know that Linus Lundqvist won that, but we're not sure where he's going to be. We've heard rumors where he's going to be. I'm thinking next week we might know where he's going to be, because there's a team right now testing at WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca. Sorry, McNeil family, I apologize. So I think we're going to find out more what's going to happen here in Indy Lights. We do have some sad news, though. We are hearing reports, and I'm still trying to get this confirmed. Exclusive Autosport was supposed to have 2 cars, but they've sold those 2 cars to HMD and Global Racing Group. So whether or not that means that GRG and HMD have 2 more cars, whether they're going to use those as backups, we're not sure. So right now we're going to say the full-time field tentatively for Indy Lights is at 12 cars. I still say we probably get to 15.
Well, 12 cars is a huge improvement from the last season. So that's great. And it's, you know, like you said, there's still plenty of time to add more.
Yeah, I don't disagree. The, you know, we've got plenty of time until the first race at Barber. So here's what we hit. Here's what we know. Able Motorsports in Indy Pro 2000, they're going to run Jacob Able, but they're also going to be a two-car team. Christian Brooks has signed with Exclusive Autosport, and Velocity Racing Development is going to run one car in Indy Pro 2000. Now, if you remember last week's show, I teased that there was going to be a team that was going to announce their intentions on going from F4 FRA or running a concurrent program into the road to Indy. This was that team. What we do know is they are going to also run two cars of Velocity Racing Development in USF 2000. One of those cars is going to have Eric Evans in it. Joe Dooling of Autosports also announced a two-car effort. Trey Burke is going to be in one of those cars. We'll find out who that second driver is going to be momentarily. Trey, actually, this weekend also racing at the Chili Bowl. Also, Turn 3 Motorsport has filled out their USF 2000 field, and Dylan Christie will be running that. As we said, he'll be on the show next week. We'll talk more with him. So I've actually got to talk. Do you have a little bit of insight? And I believe you said they're going to be running at least one car in Indy Pro 2000 for next year?
They're planning on it. Yeah, they're planning on running both series.
Okay, cool. So I've got to get a hold of Mandy, and we're going back and forth today. I was letting her know that, hey, Dylan reached out to me before and have him on. So, yeah. So there's that. But I'm actually kind of shocked about the Exclusive Autosport news. I know that they were still testing. Nikita Lastoshkin was in the car. So hopefully we'll have more from Rob Howden next week. I did reach out to Dale Coyne Racing. They still do not have a driver lineup set. But what I can confirm, I did drive past the shop today. It's not too far from me. The 18 hauler is white. So it looks like that Sealmaster's gone. At least from that hauler. It looks like that they still have the Sealmaster decal on what was the 55, which I would assume is going to go back to the 19, unless they still have that partnership with Team Go. But, 18 is TBA white.
When is the next time that IndyCars are on a track somewhere?
They are on the track next week for spring testing.
Hmm.
That's what I've heard.
Well, I guess there's still some time. I mean, there's plenty of time to put stickers on the car for for St. Pete or for whatever, wherever the season opener is. I would have to look at the schedule again. So I don't imagine that sponsorship deals are under pressure to be finalized by the season test. So I don't know if I would look too much into that.
Well, remember how many years we went with Dale having multiple drivers in one seat in one year, and it would, and you know, the side pods would change depending on who brought the money in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm liking this stable Dale Coyne Racing. This is fantastic. As somebody who grew up as a fan of Dale Coyne because he's the local team, I'm loving this. But it also sounds like that at least one of the cars will be still partnered up with Jimmy Vassar and James Sullivan. So, okay, that's great. You know, we still get Jimmy Vassar in the series. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I would be surprised if he went somewhere else for a significant amount of time.
Well, Jimmy could also start his own team, you know, or partner up with Chip Ganassi. I mean, remember, he used to be a team owner, so this, you know, none of this would surprise me.
That is true.
You know, those who are new to Open Wheel don't know that PKV was part owned by Jimmy Vassar, because it was it was Pettit, Kalkoven, and Vassar. Wow.
Speaking of that, what is Kalkoven up to these days? Is he still around?
I think he's still running Cosworth.
Hmm.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be great to get a Cosworth engine back into IndyCar? Oh, boy.
It would, especially a Ford Cosworth.
Oh, don't threaten me with a good time. That sounds fantastic.
How about a Ford Cosworth V8 turbo?
Oh, dude, don't even. No. You know, you of all people know my weakness when it comes to IndyCar engines these days.
Although I feel, as I was saying that, I sort of feel like maybe this is what, you know, we are starting to sound like to the younger generation, our older generation's talking about roadsters and front engine. At some point, I mean, I will say that the cars during the kart era, in my opinion, are probably the best cars.
Yeah.
I know that the kart era is really long, but they were all really good. But you know, I mean, we gotta you know, enjoy the memories of the past and embrace the future.
Here's the thing I will say, though. IndyCar's done a good job making those V6 turbos sound so much better than the Formula One cars. Done.
Mm-hmm.
Bar none.
Yes, that's true.
So, all right, coming up next is Ryan Sheehan. We're going to talk about his Crosslink deal in Formula 4 next on Inside Open Wheel.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Well, we talked about this in some earlier editions, a new addition to the Formula 4 Championship, more namely with Crosslink, Team Crosslink, that is, and he's busy racing this weekend in the Florida Rock Cup, and joining us here on Inside Open Wheel, taking a little bit of time out of that, is Ryan Sheehan. Ryan, thanks for joining us. I know that it's a busy weekend with racing, so what track are you at this weekend?
We are at the Isle Casino in Pompano Beach in the parking lot for a temporary track.
Let's talk about that real quick. What's it like racing on a track that's normally used for parking?
I think I prefer it, actually, because everyone's starting with a clean slate, no home advantage. Everyone has the same amount of time on track, so that's always good.
All right, let's talk about a little bit about you, where you started. Of course, we mentioned the F4 ride. We'll get to that in just a little bit. But right now, I want to ask you, how did you start your racing career in karting? I know, you know, a lot of people start in club racing. Is that where you ended up starting?
Yeah, we bought a used kart from a local family around our area. And we started at a track about an hour from my house, just doing club races, practicing almost every weekend that we weren't racing, and just did that for about a year, just to learn the ropes.
And that, I think, is a smart idea, because you see a lot of these younger kids, yeah, they'll start out karting, but they'll go right, you know, they'll go feet first into touring, whereas the club racing aspect, yeah, it's competitive, but I don't think you have as much of the intense action that you would with a touring series.
Yeah, definitely.
So when did the move from club racing to touring racing, when did that begin in earnest?
We decided to start to travel around the state and around some other states like Louisiana, Oklahoma, at the end of my first full year, so 2015. We decided for the 2016 season we should probably start to expand where we were racing.
And I've noticed it in the past several years, obviously living in the Midwest, I know a lot of good karters that go into either sports car, formula car racing, and the Southeast is like that. But it seems like in the past, you know, 4 or 5 years that a lot of the good racers come from the Texas, Louisiana area. So that's got to give you a lot of confidence seeing, you know, guys who run on the international stage or the national stage move their way up through the ranks from where you are. And you've raced them, so that's got to be interesting to see who's who and who's doing what.
Yeah, especially recently, we've seen more and more good drivers coming from Texas and the surrounding area. So that's always good to see. It means that the people you've been racing for a while and become friends with are succeeding. So that's always good.
And we're also seeing a lot of karters sign with Team Crosslink. What was the choice for you to go into Team Crosslink? And when did that conversation kind of take fold?
I think the main thing that people are looking for is the ladder program from Karts to Cars. That was definitely a factor that we took into account, and we chose Crosslink back at the end of 2018. When our previous team, the owner decided to retire. So we were looking for new home.
And with CrossLink, obviously, you've become more competitive. You've traveled not just around the South, but you've traveled around the country as well. So you're getting a taste of drivers that you may be racing against soon or you've raced against.
Yeah, definitely. Even some that I've raced with on the national scale, I'll also be racing with in the Formula 4 season this year.
And last year was a big season for you, not only because you started the move up to Formula 4, but also you were chosen as a contender for Mazda's Club Racing Factory team. We've heard a little bit about that, but let's dive into what the process began with. And I think it started early last year, correct?
Yeah, we got a message from Rob Howden asking if we were interested in sports car racing. So, of course, we said yes. And then we didn't hear much until mid-October when we got an email from David Cook from Mazda announcing the nominee program for the Mazda Factory Club team.
Ryan Sheen joins us on Inside Open Wheel. He'll be running for the F4 Rookie of the Year this year in Team CrossLink. Now, what was that process like when David Cook contacted you? How did the wheels start moving?
So we got an email, all the nominees, and then about a week later, we had a big meeting, a phone call with all the nominees talking about everything from the process to how it was going to be narrowed down to the finalists and everything we needed to do. And then we had about 3 weeks after that to get everything together and do our submittal.
Now, as we know, you weren't chosen as the champion, but things worked out in the end because you ended up moving up with Team CrossLink. Were you able to test an F4 car before you made the announcement that you were going up to F4 to kind of get you to figure out if this is the next step you wanted to make in your racing career?
Yeah, we had the opportunity in late November to try it out before signing any contract just to see if it was a viable option for 2021. And I guess it went well because a couple weeks later got the contract.
Now, a couple of drivers we've talked to that, you know, after their first test, it's the first time that they've been, you know, in a race car, or it's the first time they've dealt with a car with downforce. What is it like going from a kart into a race car? Granted, it doesn't have a ton of downforce, but enough to get by to where you can get through corners quick enough.
Yeah, there's definitely a learning curve once you start to get any sort of aero. Definitely feel like carrying the speed and trusting the car is the hardest part in making the transition.
As I was saying, there's got to be a certain speed to where the aero kicks in, because if it doesn't, well, you just might as well take the wings off because you're running a car without, you know, the need for aero.
Yeah, definitely. You have to learn that. It may not feel like it's going to hold, but you have to carry the speed to activate the aero, and then it'll hold.
So how did you prepare yourself to test an F4 car for the first time?
So lots of physical training, cardio, core, neck stuff. And then on the driving side, lots of simulator work, learning the tracks, getting used to the feeling of a car, just the overall general stuff. I think the simulator is a big help for learning tracks, since you get a lot less track time in the car compared to a kart.
And I want to talk about the learning curve there, because now that you're going to be racing in F4 next year, you're going to race on some tracks you're familiar with, some tracks you're not familiar with, but you have such great depth and teammates that run in F4 and FR Americas that really you're not necessarily going in blind going into the season.
Yeah, I've gotten some good tips from my teammates who have been to the common tracks like Mid-Ohio, COTA, where F4 has been in the past few years. So those are always helpful. And I definitely think that they'll help me hit the ground running when we get to those tracks.
And the West Coast tracks too, that's got to be good for you because everybody comes in with a blank slate. So you have a chance to contend at those tracks as well.
Yeah. And it's probably a good thing that the season starts there so we can start off with some good weekends while we get used to the car.
Now, you said simulator work. How much simulator work are you putting in when you're not at the kart track to prepare yourself for this season?
Usually almost every day, a couple hours, depending on scheduling. Maybe a little less now that school's picked back up, but during breaks, it was pretty heavy.
And I would assume that also you're leaning on, you know, your teammates who've been there, you know, have constantly talking to each other, getting off the sim saying, hey, you know, this is what I did, you know, take a look at this or something like that. Do you have conversations with the engineers as well on setup changes?
Not as much on the sim, but definitely during test days is when we can really talk about what a certain change is going to do and then try it out in a stress-free, you know, doesn't really matter if you go slower as long as we know what this change does. So I definitely think that those are helpful.
And for you, what excites you the most about moving into Formula 4? We know the competition's tight. You know, we've seen several races where you didn't know who's going to win until the last corner of the last lap. But what excites you the most about making the switch to Formula 4?
Definitely think that the speed, the competition, and the strategy aspect. The races are a lot longer than karting races, so you kind of have to have some tire management, race management, just a lot more strategizing during the races than in a kart.
I was going to say, because, you know, you're in that cart for, you know, maybe 12, 15 minutes for a feature race, but now you're worried about half hour races. So you also got to worry about your stamina in the off season too.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a bit more physical than a cart, just in terms of overall strength, the wheels heavier, pulling more G's, you're in it for longer. So definitely have to put in the work while training to get ready for that.
Well, Ryan, I got to say this. This is going to be an exciting season because it looks like that it's going to be a super competitive F4 season if last year's any clue. So how can fans follow your progress on social media?
We have pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. RyanSheehan.com is our website. You can check that out. But just searching up Ryan Sheehan Racing, we should be the first thing to pop up on any major social media platform.
Well, Ryan, I'll make a deal with you. You get yourself to the top step of the podium this year, and we'll vault you on to next week's show. So you've got a goal for next year.
Sounds great.
Ryan Sheehan, good luck this weekend at the Florida ROK Cup, and we'll see you down the road.
Thank you.
Coming next on Inside Open Wheel, we start our Legends of Open Wheel series with the one, the only Paul Page. The wait is over. Inside Open Wheel is now on Apple Podcasts. So no matter where you get your favorite podcast from, you can always get a new episode of Inside Open Wheel on that same program. Heck, you can even get a push notification right when we release new episodes. Once again, Inside Open Wheel, we're now on Apple Podcasts.
The pace car is into the pits. Tom Sneva, the pole sitter, brings them down. Pat Mann with the green flag watches the field. And the green flag is out. The 1977 500 is on.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
And we kick off our 2021 edition of Legends of Open Wheel with someone I consider a friend, a mentor, and one that I'm really happy we have him on. You know him as the voice of IndyCars from the 1970s all the way till really now, but there's more to Paul Page that you may or may not know. And Paul, thanks for taking the time to join us here on Inside Open Wheel's Legends of Open Wheel Racing. It's, as I said, it's an honor every time we talk, honestly. It's a privilege.
Well, I appreciate that. It's good to be with you. I hope we have some fun.
Oh, I'm excited. So what I know a lot about, you know, the history and all that. So you started out in motorsports, actually following Formula One at the time. But this was also the time when Formula One, you know, you had some guys cross over, come to the 500, because that was a time when F1 points paid for the 500.
Yeah, well, actually, going back, I started following Formula One when I was like 8 or 9 years old. I'm a military brat, and we were stationed in Stuttgart, Germany. And I got to see a Formula One race. And I want to say it's the 1954 event at Nürburgring. Don't hold me to that. But so I liked racing. I wasn't crazy about it, but I enjoyed it. And then my great uncle brought me down from, we were stationed at Fort Sheridan on North Shore of Chicago, mm-hmm. For the 1960 Indy 500. And the race hadn't even started. And I was like, oh, this is the best thing ever. You know, the crowd, everything about it was cool. When I saw the race cars, it got just awesome.
Well, one of your other friends, Bob Jenkins, even said that was his first race that he went to. So that 1960 race was impressionable to a whole bunch of race fans of that generation, and some who went on to become legendary broadcasters.
Yeah, I think Robin Miller is also part
yep.
of that. I
Robin,
think 60
yes.
was his first.
Yeah, so that race alone, I think, like I said, cemented a lot, because you hear about that, and you know, sometimes I get a chance to listen to Sid Collins' broadcast on the IMS Radio Network when they play it on TuneIn, and it's amazing the back and forth, even back then, the close competition, because there were some races you had snoozers because, you know, the guy was, you know, 30, 40 seconds ahead, but yet you have the Rathman Ward battle, you know, down to the wire.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. And I was a fan of Rathman. I only became that during the race because I really liked the blue of his car. It was a really pretty car. And Ward's was, you know, white with the Flying W emblem on the front. So I liked the blue car, and the blue car won.
So at what point did you decide that you're going to take a career in motorsports? I know at this point, you know, you haven't even thought of that. You're too young to think about that. But when do you think, you know, I want to start working in motorsports?
Well, it's interesting you use the word career, because I've never thought about what I was doing as a career. I was following my own belief that if you have a passion for something and you do it, you will be rewarded, whatever reward really is. So I developed a passion at that first race, but I was kind of pulled. There was one point when I was racing a Formula Ford that I actually thought I was a race driver, which may have been the stupidest thing I ever did. But I did it for a whole 7 years. It worked out because it taught me how difficult it is to really be a race driver, and especially in that particular class. I liked the radio, and I was kind of bouncing between the two and finally found my place.
I want to touch on your racing exploits in Formula Ford, now known as Formula 1600. What drew you to that class?
Because it looked like an Indy car.
Okay, yeah.
It was an
I can see that.
I went to my first driver's school. I had my own Fiat 124 Spider. And I over-revved it during the driver's school and spun the bearings on it. And so a buddy of mine who had a Lotus 51 Formula Ford loaned it to me for the second day to finish the school. And I bought it from him. And it was, like I say, a Lotus 51. So we're talking 1969-70 version, just as the class was starting. And it didn't have a Hewlin. It had a Renault gearbox, which you could move trees around if you wanted to with it, but you couldn't really go fast. So I finally bought a Eldon Mark 10C so that I could have a decent car with a decent gearbox and race that until 1977.
And I say, by this time, you're starting to work with the network. So how much experience do you take in your racing and kind of move it towards your broadcast?
Well, not so much. Excuse me. The racing taught me a lot about how to be, especially with the Formula Ford, very gentle. And it taught me how turning the front wheels would really slow you down. And so you didn't want to do that, if, you know, at a minimum. It taught me everything mechanical about a race car. I read several engineering books, and of course it got me hanging around with the Pat Racing team and George Nani. In fact, I kept my Eldon at their shop. And so mechanically, I really understood the cars as a result of that, but as a result of really the combination of, I have actually helped work on building a couple of the Wildcats. I put the Clecos in and things like that. And I could string a car and balance it pretty good in those days. So those things all helped me understand what they were up against.
Let's go ahead and talk about back to the radio side of things. Before you were at the IMS Radio Network, you worked at a station that both you and I have been on, WIBC in Indianapolis. It's the big news talk in central Indiana. And you come across the voice of the 500, Sid Collins.
Yep. And I was trying to be a disc jockey, and it wasn't working. And I just got let go because the station I was at went automated. So I went up to WIBC, again with the idea of trying to be a disc jockey, because that was my thing. And they said, well, we don't have anything. And I went in part because I knew Sid was there. And they said, well, we don't have anything except news. Would you like to try news? And sure, that sounds great. And I loved every minute of it. Becoming a journalist and learning journalism as a reporter was one of the great moments of my life. But then I also had Sid there, who at first totally disapproved of my interviewing technique. But he so disapproved, he sat me down and taught me how to interview. And then we became very close friends. And he finally, in 1975, said he was going to turn the race over to me. And he planned to do it in 1977. Unfortunately, he didn't live to see the 1977 race. We were going to change over mid-race.
Now, I've got to ask, in 77, how prepared were you going into that month, knowing that at some point during the race you were going to take the call? How prepared were you? And then all of a sudden, these plans blow wide open because we've lost Sid Collins.
At the time, I thought that I was totally prepared. I had everything I thought that I needed to do. I was also totally wrong. You have to sit in that chair before you find out all of the little nuances of it. Sid told me everything he could, but there were some things that were so natural to him, he didn't think that it was important to tell me. Like, people would come in and hand me different pieces of paper. I had no idea who they were or what the paper was supposed to be about. And the way the whole system worked was kind of alien to me. In fact, we changed the system that Sid used. His races were kind of in a past tense, in that a guy on the turns, if he saw an accident, he would get in contact with the producer in the control tower, and the producer, Jack Morrow, would then write that on a 3x5 card and hand it to Sid, and then Sid would deal with it. He will have earlier said, well, we have the yellow on, and, you know, find out what it is. Not to take anything away from Sid, that was pretty remarkable in those days, but I wanted to try to get it in real time, and I think that's what we did in 77.
And because at that time, you know, if you listen to the 500 broadcast from when they started all the way till at that point, you heard less and less of Sid interviewing guests because the action was just too fast. And I think with you coming in and saying, yep, no guests, we're just going to broadcast the race, again, not taking anything away from Sid, that brought an extra step in elevating the broadcast.
Yeah, well, Sid was facing a problem as he had established a number of traditions within his own broadcast, like giving the rundown of the race every 10 laps. Well, when he started, that was absolutely necessary in 1952, 1953, and 4, because the laps were so long. I mean, we didn't get into the one-minute lap until 1961. So he had all, and that was qualifying time. So it certainly wasn't a race time. So he had developed different elements to kind of eat up that time in between events happening on the track. And the 500, like it still does to this day, is like furious at the start, through the first pit stop, maybe the second. Then it kind of goes static for a while, and everybody tends to hold position. Changes only happen as a result of something in the pits or an accident. And then it fires up in the last 75 miles. But so Sid had all these different techniques. Giving the 10-lap rundown was one of them. But when I took it over, the idea of being able to do a 10-lap rundown would merely have me going from one to the other. Because by the time I got through the 10th, and certainly if I went for 33, it was time now for the next 10-lap rundown. So there was a lot of things that had to come out of it that Sid had built into it, but never changed it coming forward.
We'll have more with Paul Page in just a little bit. Coming up next on Inside Open Wheel is the recap from Sunday's Inside Open Wheel 225 with the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Kokomo Indy Elite Series.
This is Inside Open Wheel with Jeremy Scott.
Our first foray into race sponsorship happened on Sunday, and I've got to say this much, Charlie. I was pretty pleased. Well, to get my thoughts on the race here in just a little bit, I'm surprised that you actually finished the race. I'm surprised you made the race. No, I'm kidding. 20th place, not bad. You're running up pretty high there in the middle part of the race, but got to say, that was an interesting race for you.
Yeah, I think I qualified like 32nd or 31st, and I finished 20th. So in the first race of the season, I equaled my best finish of last season. I think I was pretty much fighting understeer the entire race, but it's better than the alternative. I'm sure I made a few strategic blunders, but I'm pretty much in these races, like I've said before, the competition level is so high that my long-standing goal is to just finish every race.
So here's my question to you. Can you not change your wing adjustments during your pit stops?
You have wing adjustments. I'm not entirely sure of all the things that you can change in a pit stop. In the car, we have, front and rear anti-roll bars and the weight jacker that we can change. You're constantly changing the weight jacker throughout the race, up or down.
Sam Horsch Jr. checking in.
What's that?
So it's Sam Horsch Jr. checking in.
Yeah, I mean, you got to deal with the lightning fuel loads and the changing tire wear. So it's a big part of doing well in the series is making those adjustments on the fly.
And by the way, Kyle Heyer and Tom O'Gorman couldn't join us because they were they're busy calling some other races for SimTV. We're going to try and get a better schedule here. Tell you what, the Coca-Cola Bottling Company Kokomo Indy Elite Series really did not disappoint on action. We'll talk more about the tire strategy as well a little bit later on. But green flag flew, and then a lap later went to yellow with a multi-car crash. Gotta say, you did a great job avoiding it for the most part.
Yeah, well, avoiding wrecks is kind of what I do, isn't it?
For those who don't know, Charlie has a very famous video on YouTube of him avoiding the big one at the Montreal Grand Prix. What was that? 04, 05?
2006.
So definitely, if you get a chance, look up the 2006 Star Mazda Canadian Grand Prix, and you'll see the video.
Well, or you could just search around on my youtube.com/antispeed.
There you go.
And it's up there somewhere.
There's a self-promotion we all know and love. All right.
I saw my chance and I took it.
There you go. Wish you'd do that more on track. Anyway, back to the race. So that bunched up the field for a little bit. Once we got back to green, a lot of middle-of-the-pack racing action. You would work your way up to... did you work your way up to, I think it was 13th you were up to at one point. But there were some interesting pit strategies that I noticed during the race as well. We had a couple drivers pit early in the pit window, others later on. And there is the next caution. I should take more notes of these like I do normal races. I can't remember what lap that was, but there's Don Hunter was a spinner, bringing out the yellow back under green. Christopher DeMaire, the winner, actually did quite well running up near the front most of the race. 86 second yellow where Stoffer hit the wall and others made some great evasion. I've got to say this. Now, I know we talked about this in the last week's episode, but man, iRacing doing a great job of not making the cars fly into space once they hit a wall or each other actually looked like an actual race.
Yeah, that's the new damage model they introduced, I want to say earlier last year. Mm-hmm. I think basically I remember reading that what the problem is that when a race car hits a wall or crashes or something, obviously parts fly off and that's energy being dissipated away, right?
Right.
But up until now or up until recently, they didn't have parts flying off. So all of that energy is retained in the car. As it crashes and tumbles, all the energy that would have been flown off with the pieces is continued. And it continues just bouncing and tumbling and bouncing and takes forever.
Yeah, and it made it look a lot more realistic. So kudos to the iRacing staff for getting that done. Another yellow just past halfway where Kingsbury, he hit the wall, making contact with Brendan Lichtenberg off turn two. And really, this is where pit strategy came into play because DeMaret, race leader at the time, pitted twice under the yellow. Once before green, and once those was prior to the green, handing the lead to Andreas Eick. We thought, okay, Eick block, or they're going to come near the front, DeMaret, near the back of the pack. But we saw DeMaret methodically work his way up near the front. He took a gamble there at the end. And he, the rest of the race remained green. We saw, Flynn Lazier, Schoen, Kraus, they tried to gamble. It didn't work out. DeMaret ending up taking the win. Four cautions, 15 laps, 12 lead changes at Homestead Miami Speedway. Virtual Homestead Miami Speedway, that is. We'll have the next race on Sims.TV Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 Central. And you can follow that on Indy Elite's Facebook, Twitter. We'll get that out there as well. So my thought...
I believe they're at Phoenix.
Yeah, they're at Phoenix. Yeah, Phoenix is the next race. So my thoughts on the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Kokomo Indy Elite Series. Holy crap, was that fantastic. I was very impressed with the level of competition. I was impressed with the level of the broadcast. I've got to say this. It felt like an actual real race, and which is more than what I can say about the IndyCar Challenge and some of the other races I've seen where it's like, okay, it's sim racing. No, I was actually intrigued. There were a lot of great battles that were being followed throughout the race, and this open style format needs to be adopted in more racing series, bar none. The fixed racing format, don't even worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, like I said in the interview with Kyle, I think it's a combination of a couple things. I think the biggest is the level of commitment that it takes, because you need to put hours and hours of practice time to start getting these setups to be competitive. So that's just the level of preparation is much higher. With the open setups, you can kind of just like, especially on the ovals, you can just sort of do like 5 or 6 laps and be like, okay, I think I know what to do. Because you can't change anything. So why would you spend any more time than that? And also, I think there's a dynamic if you compare it to when the real IndyCar drivers were doing sim racing. I think that they probably weren't really taking it seriously. I mean, obviously they weren't. When you have things like what happened with Simone Pagenaud. But you know, these are the iRacing IndyCar drivers that know that this is the closest we're ever going to get to being IndyCar drivers. And it helps us to sort of live the dream a little bit. And I mean, people in this series take it very seriously.
Well, and also take a look at, you take a look at Simon Pagenaud and how serious he took it. But yet you take a look at, Scott McLaughlin. Yeah, he didn't have the setup like I'm sure he has now because he's here in the States and he's able to get it from his Penske teammates. But he still took it seriously because he was working with his race engineer every week. They were communicating. The race engineer's watching in spotter mode. And, he's playing spotter too. But he was able to, they were able to work on the car. So this, though, it was great because you had drivers in there who, some work in the sport, some like you've raced before. And then there's some who they've never been on a track in their life. And It was a damn good show. And I'm excited for one of my favorite ovals in all of open wheel racing this weekend, Phoenix.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the road courses personally, but the ovals are a lot of fun as well. And Phoenix, even with the new format, I guess it's not new. It's been around for more than a decade now.
Well, it kind of is new because they've moved the start finish to old 1 and 2. I consider the new layout, how they have it now, to be less than a decade because they modified a couple things.
I'm not sure how up to date the iRacing Phoenix is.
Boy, I think you should be testing instead of being on the air, damn it.
Well, that's why I'm part of a team. I don't know anything about these the oval setups. I mean, I can contribute a little bit to the road course setups, but I mean the oval setups just don't make any sense to me. I don't know, especially at Indy, but even everywhere else. I mean, I understand crossweight a little bit, I guess, but beyond that, I'm totally lost.
Well, how many ovals have you run in real life?
One.
And that was Milwaukee, right?
Yep.
Man, I'm good. Well, and that you can make a case for that in saying that's a road course because it's flat.
Yeah, it felt, I mean, it's kind of funny. It's what, 14 degrees of banking?
Milwaukee?
Yeah.
No.
No.
No. Oh, now I've got to go look this up.
I don't know. I'm not good with numbers, but it's,
I can tell.
Okay. See, this is how little I know. It was at Indy that's 14 degrees of banking.
No, Indy's 9 degrees, and so is Milwaukee Mile. Chicagoland, I think, is 14 degrees.
Wait, Indy and Milwaukee have the same banking?
So Milwaukee Mile's 9 degrees in the turns. Give me 1 second. Okay, Indianapolis Motor Speedway. 9 point, yeah, it's basically about the same. So Indy's at 9.2 degrees. Milwaukee's at 9.25 degrees.
Huh. I never really put that together.
I didn't either. It's the first time. Or Chicagoland, it's not going to tell me. Give me a second. I actually got to go look at this. 18 degrees of Chicagoland. And I can tell you this from experience, it kind of seems cheaper, or steeper in the in a car, especially a pace car.
Well, I think we've all just confirmed what I said earlier, but I don't know anything about it.
You turn left. That's all we need to know. So
yes.
All right. It's getting to be that time. So coming up on Inside Open Wheel, I'm just going to hand the reins over to Paul Page here. We're going to have the second part of our Legends of Open Wheel series next.
AJ Foyt down the main straightaway. The checkered flag is out. AJ's hand in the air. He is the winner. AJ Foyt at Indianapolis has won his fourth 500-mile race. AJ Foyt, our winner. The flag will fly now for Tom Sneva and then for Al Unser.
This is Inside Open Wheel. Now, here's Jeremy Scott.
Also at that point for the race, that was the final final race for Fred Agabashian. Did he say before the race that, hey, you know what, I'm done, this is it? Or was it after the race, go to you and say, I've retired?
Never actually said it.
Wow.
I didn't know he was doing it. Freddie and I were really close when Sid did pass early in May of 77. He and I and Sid's lawyer, a guy named Henry Bradshaw, and Ray Trotta, who was one of Sid's best friends, ran Sid's restaurant, Gasoline Alley, for him. Also ran the Ayers Tea Room in Indianapolis, which is pretty well known. Freddie was there with these other guys and me to help take Sid's apartment apart. He had no family, so we were the guys that were going to have to do that. And I remember at one point Freddie standing there, and Sid had a third bedroom that was literally a warehouse and boxes of stuff he'd acquired over the years that he used as giveaways. You know, he might call you over and say, hey, this is for you. Thanks for your help. You know, and one of them was a box of Champion spark plug cufflinks. And Fred looked at him and said, we haven't had these for 15 years. So that was part of the joy of Sid, was he did those kind of things. And he'd even at the station look at you and say, you're what, a 42, 44? And, you know, yeah. I got some shirts. They've only been worn once. I'm like, really, Sid? He was the most parsimonious human being I ever met, and I would tease him about it endlessly, and he enjoyed every minute of it.
So you move on to next year. Mike Hiss ends up as your driver expert. At what point do the television networks come to you and say, you know, we like your stuff. Why don't you come out and do play-by-play of our television stuff?
That happened in 1979, so I'd done two races, actually three races by then. And in that summer of 79, I apologize, 78. Years are very confusing sometimes. I did a USAC stock car race at Michigan for NBC. And I did a IndyCar race at Texas World Speedway for CBS. And both of them liked what I was doing and had offered me jobs literally on the same day. So, you know, how cool was that?
Yeah.
Decided on NBC because if I was there, NBC didn't have the Indy 500. I could still do the Indy 500 but keep my regular job without a problem. And so that's what I did.
And before anybody asks, we're going to kind of skip over the 77 helicopter crash because even as a traffic reporter, no, we're not going to talk.
Whoa.
Well, unless you want to.
Biggest touchdown Speedway High School ever had, okay? I actually did some news from that, but I was the straight man for the morning and afternoon drive guys, and it was good fun. I was also at the time going through a paramedic course. And one time there was an accident. I was covering the accident and the Marion County EMS helicopter arrived and sat down. And then we got a call from them and said, we don't have any EMT or paramedic on board. And we really needed a paramedic. Will you come over to our helicopter and do it? So I did. We landed. I hopped out, went over to the other one. And as luck would have it, in the midst of that flight, after we picked the patient up and heading for the hospital, I got a call on my walkie-talkie to do another traffic report. And so I did it. And Chuck Riley was the afternoon guy, and he said, it sounds different for some reason. And I had to come up with something quick. I said, yeah, well, I've stepped out on the veranda for a few minutes. It sounds different. And nobody ever knew what we were actually doing. I never told the station or anybody. I was afraid I'd get fired for doing it.
You know, there was one time, get off track real quick. I know some people, you know, obviously working in the industry, I know people who are airborne. One of my friends who now is in racing himself, he used to fill in for Air 780 here in Chicago. And it just happened that one day they ran out of fuel in the Cessna 172. So here they come coming in for a landing. And as they're going down, they're like, oh, by the way, you're going to hear about a plane landing in a golf course. Yeah, that's us.
That's perfect. That's perfect.
So at what point do you decide that, you know, WIBC, it's great, but going to focus more on the motorsports, you know, motorsport working, you know, Olympics, doing different stuff?
You mean at WIBC? Or I don't entirely understand
for. You know, after the WIBC, where you start working for like NBC and ABC with Olympics and other sports coverage.
Right. Okay. Well, when I was with NBC for the 10 years I was there, about 3 or 4 years of that, I kept my job in Indianapolis. After the helicopter crash, I'd gone to work as a television reporter for the ABC station then in Indianapolis. And so I kept my regular job until the first couple of years with a network, they kind of feel you out and they, you know, they make a deal for like 5 races or 5 events a year. And then they finally give you a full-time contract if they're satisfied. And so when I had the full-time contract, I quit my job in local television and stayed totally with the network after that.
Now, at that point, your wife, Sally, when does she, you know, she obviously worked with you on a couple of races with IMS Radio Network near the end. When does she get into the motorsports pit reporting?
Well, she came in I want to say 1980, certainly right in that era. And I didn't hire her. Radio Network manager hired her because she was such a good journalist. She's really awesome and does great interviews. And I had to withdraw myself. It's the only announcer that I didn't have a part in hiring. I hired Bob Jenkins. I hired all but everybody else after that. And Larry Henry and those guys. But that one, they wanted a female, and I was a little worried because we were married, that, you know, might speak of nepotism, but they kept me out of that problem. Now, I don't know how much of the public believe that, but and she had no interest in racing whatsoever. She just married a guy who was into racing. And what happened was she was total professional in the approach and really was on top of everything. So it was rough for her. There were some guys that say, you can't come in our pits. We don't want women in our pits. That thing still hadn't totally gone away.
Yeah.
Vince Granatelli, one of them, and my wife's Italian. Vince was Italian. They really got into it. And after that, they were best friends.
I was going to say, that was the point where, yeah, if you're a woman, you can come in, you can score, but that's about it.
Yep. Yeah, it was tough. Those were very tough days. I find it really hard when I think back that when I started going to the track covering anything, that there were no women allowed in the pits, and there were all kinds of other little issues that went around. I mean, that was definitely a man's kingdom there. And none of us thought too much about it and showed how really sexist we were, as we didn't realize there was a difference and that there should be. But like Betty Rutherford and Sally and a gal named Murta Pulliam, they really banged on the door, and then there was a lawsuit filed, and that got women in the pits.
Let's talk about the call from ABC when they decide, after they do their live broadcast of the 500. What was that like when they gave you the call saying, we want you to host, you know, basically be the call for the Indianapolis 500 on live TV?
Well, I had some forewarning of that. They did the 86 race live, and they did the 87 race live. Both of them, the Speedway was not satisfied with the performance. And Mary George told me that they would like to get me in to call the race on television. And, you know, Mary George says, we're going to do this.
Yep.
And so I got a call actually in 87 from ABC. They couldn't twist around and do it that year, though they hired me in 87, and I did some other stuff. And so I'd left NBC to go to ABC. And then we did our first live race. I did my first live television race of the Indy 500 in 1988.
How much stranger was that, doing it from radio to TV?
I hated TV. and my buddy Bob Jenkins, he loves TV and hates radio. So go figure. I didn't like TV because of the loss of control. I always said that in those days that you were actually limited by the 21-inch screen. Didn't benefit you in any way, because people in a truck, and generally people who didn't understand what racing was all about, were making the decisions on what the pictures would be. And in that job, you have to, the audience is only seeing the pictures. So you have to go with the pictures. You can maybe wend other stuff in, but action stuff can't happen. You can't say, okay, we're looking at AJ Foyt. He's in second place. We've been watching him for six laps now. He's not doing anything. But while we're watching this, I want to tell you that there is a great battle for 17th going on.
Yeah.
That just doesn't fly. So you couldn't do it. Radio, you could. Radio, you could do. You could cover events that happened simultaneously on radio. Just, you did a little slipping of the time, and it worked perfectly.
And that's one thing I tell, you know, my wife and I go back and forth with this. She's like, "Well, I like seeing it on TV," but I'm like, "Look, yeah, it's great, but you only see the top five on TV. You listen to radio, and, you know, we'll cover the battle for 17th because, yeah, it may not be important for TV, but dang, they're fighting tooth and nail for that 17th spot."
Well, plus in radio, there's that that battle in the theater of the mind.
Yes.
Sid was the one that really understood that best of all, though he didn't call it that. But he understood that his job was to take you from wherever in the world you were and put you in a seat at Indianapolis. And so where on television, we just kind of look at the cars and the teams only. Sid wrapped everything in. And of course, I learned from him, so I did as well. Television doesn't do things like that. Even when it's really, really good, it doesn't do things like that.
For more of the Legends of Open Wheel interview with Paul Page, you can catch it in its entirety on any of the same podcasting services to which you get Inside Open Wheel. Now, coming up on next week's program, we welcome Road to Indy insider Rob Howden. He'll be discussing the TireRack.com E-Series and his new position within the Road to Indy. Dylan Christie was one of the standouts in the F1600 Championship last year, but this year he takes on a new challenge with the USF 2000 Championship in Turn 3 Motorsport. Freem is a safety company that's been growing in Europe, and now they have a U.S. distributor, and we'll welcome Ryan Beechner to discuss his new partnership. We'll also recap the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Kokomo Indy Elite Series at Phoenix Raceway, which you can catch on Sim.TV Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern. That is SYM.TV. So for Ryan Sheehan, Paul Page, and our driver analyst, Charlie Ante, we thank you for listening to Inside Open Wheel. Special thanks to the IMS Radio Network for their clips of the 1977 Indianapolis 500. Inside Open Wheel is a production of Trackout Multimedia.